case of the day, Florence Crowe versus Ziegler Coal Company.
Thank you, Your Honor. I'm Jim Spetta, representing the petitioner, Mrs. Crowe. May it please the Court. In three regards, the agency conducted this black lung proceeding without regard to fundamental principles of administrative law and the text and policies of the Black Lung Act. The agency's most fundamental legal error was to keep this formal adjudicatory proceeding alive for more than 3 years after its only proponent, the coal company, was dissolved in bankruptcy and no other party appeared to prosecute the proceeding.
Can I stop you there?
Of course.
If the surety had at that time moved to intervene, it would be a different case, wouldn't it?
Absolutely, Your Honor. The other alternative under the statute is that the director of the Office of Workers' Compensation Programs could have simply intervened on the agency's own behalf to prosecute the claim and wouldn't have had to do anything except to adopt the arguments that were already in the record on behalf of the coal company.
So it's the timeliness of it. 3 years later, when you wait and see how the law develops, then you decide to intervene and expose yourself. That's your argument with what happened.
Yes. My first legal argument is that during the three-year period, the law of the Black Lung Act and of the regulations required the proceeding to be dismissed for want of prosecution. And had it been dismissed, then the prior award of benefits in favor of my client would have stood as the last final order in this proceeding. Now, you're correct that, of course, the Travelers Companies argues that its three-year-later intervention renders all of this moot. But we have to realize that the three-years-later intervention is not based on some new knowledge that the Travelers Company received. The coal company was dissolved in September of 2004, and in February of 2005, the director of the Office of Workers' Compensation Program wrote to Travelers, identified their bond as potentially at issue as a surety for this claim, and in the text of the letter said, you may intervene in this proceeding to protect your rights. That was February of 2005, and they didn't do anything. Second, in 2006, this claim, after the ALJ's second opinion, which found no entitlement of benefits, we appealed to the Benefits Review Board, a second appeal in this proceeding, and the attorneys for the coal companies, Ms. Klaus, who's here today representing Travelers, filed a brief in the Benefits Review Board, to which we said, there is no coal company, they cannot file a brief in this case, and again asked, we've asked at every stage of the proceeding since 2005 for the case to be dismissed. And the Benefits Review Board said, the employer's counsel, the employer's former counsel, is here to represent the interests of the employer. Now, we think the illegality of this flows almost inevitably from this court's decision in the Melvin case, in which the court made clear that an utterly dissolved entity cannot bring an appeal to this court because it is not a party in interest. It has nothing at stake from the entry of an appeal reversing an order of compensation. Now, to be sure, the fundamental reason in that case was one of Article III standing, but as we show in the brief, the same rule has to apply in the proceeding in front of the administrative agency. That is because the proceedings under the Black Lung Act are formal adjudications under the Administrative Procedures Act. Indeed, the statute says, as incorporated in the Longshore Act, as incorporated by the Black Lung Act, a petition for modification, which is what this case was, is subject to exactly those same formal adjudication rules, and in a modification proceeding, the party seeking modification, here the coal company, is the proponent. In Metropolitan Stevedore versus Rambo, the Supreme Court made clear that, quote, when an employer seeks modification of a previously awarded compensation, the employer is the proponent of the order with the burden of proof.
Let me stop you there. But when you're in front of the BRB and counsel comes in and says, well, I'm here for the coal company, had the Travelers intervened at that time and had their own lawyer there, it would be a different matter, I take it. They said, we're the surety. As the surety, this court's held that you can be here, you can say your interests are at stake, but that's not what happened.
That is almost 18 months after the director's letter of February 2005 saying, we've identified you as a potentially responsible party and you should intervene in this proceeding. I would say 18 months is untimely. The question, I suppose...
Well, wouldn't the surety know when this Ziegler Coal Company was going under? I mean, wouldn't they be given notice in bankruptcy that one of their insureds is on the line and is going under? I mean, did the Department of Labor even have to tell them that you're here?
Well, probably not, Your Honor, but the only piece of record evidence that I have of the department notifying the insurer is the February 2005 letter. I think you have to be exactly right that as a matter of bankruptcy proceeding, as a matter of Travelers, a sophisticated insurance company, understanding what its liability was going to be when Horizon and Ziegler were dissolved, they had to have known long before even February 2005. And they did not intervene. I can't prove that they didn't intervene for the purpose of not appearing and therefore not making themselves as easily available to us in this proceeding. I certainly think that constitutes prejudice if prejudice is required. But I just don't think that the lawlessness of allowing a three-year proceeding where an administrative law judge simply keeps the proceeding going on his own without any advocate to the proceeding constitutes rational decision-making.
Mr. Spetta, could you articulate, I guess, a little more specifically for me your concept of prejudice and what advantage you think the surety obtained by delaying the intervention so long after the notice?
I think what the principal item of prejudice would be a statement from the surety that they are the potentially liable party. That is an agreement with the possible identification by the department that they are the party at issue.
Now, to the they step forward, and then you know that you're entitled to seek payment from them.
Right. We actually have a theory of this case which hasn't been endorsed yet by the administrative agency, although if you adopt our theory of the case now, it will be essentially endorsing that theory, that we were entitled to the $168,000 in back benefits awarded in June of 2001, whether or not they win this modification proceeding, right? And so,
clear under Section 922 of the Longshoremen's Act?
It is clear.
The modification doesn't remove.
It is clear under Section 922 to us of the Longshore Act and Section 725.502 of the regulations. But the traveler's position and the coal company's position has been in this litigation that the order in 2001 awarding benefits was not a final order. We think that's wrong, but we haven't been able to get the department to agree with us in that regard.
Let me ask you, Mr. Spetta, to help me understand something. I will confess this is my first encounter with the Black Lung Act, although I know both of my colleagues know much more about it than I do. But can you identify for me what cash has changed hands under this claim, covering what periods of time?
Yes, Your Honor, I can do that. This initial claim was brought in the 90s by Mr. Crow. It ended up in this court in 1999, went back to the Department of Labor in 2001, and we received an order from the administrative law judge finding that Mr. Crow was entitled to benefits. At that point, there was an order of payment, and the coal company did not pay. They wrote a letter to the department, in fact, saying, "We won't pay." We weren't copied on that letter. But when they didn't pay, then the Black Lung Disability Trust Fund steps in to pay monthly benefits and for a period of time did pay monthly benefits to Mr. Crow.
For how long?
Mm-hmm. I don't know the precise number of months, but I can tell you actually that Mrs. Crow recently received a letter asking for all of that money back, and it was $52,000 in total in monthly benefits.
What theory was it being sought back?
On the theory that from 2001 to approximately 2004, when the ALJ first entered the modification order denying benefits, and then at a period of time thereafter up until the Benefits Review Board ruled in 2006, the trust fund paid benefits, and then a modification order goes into effect. And a modification order does reach back to the time that the modification proceeding is filed. And so they are entitled under the statute, that is, the trust fund is entitled under the statute to ask for that money back. We think that she won't have to pay it because she was not at fault for having received the money, even if they could trace it through to her. But under Section 9501 of the Internal Revenue Code, the trust fund may not pay the accumulated back benefits. So the $168,000, which represents the amount of benefits that Mr. Crow ought to have received under the ALJ's order, finding that the date of onset of his disability was in the 90s and he was owed benefits up until the date of the compensation order in 2001, has never been paid.
Well, let me ask you about that. In response to your argument that what happened here was unjust under the Act, the Benefit Review Board, I thought, said, let me find the right provision. I thought it said, well, the refusal to pay the 2001 order really only affected other coal companies, so your client doesn't have a beef. But if I understand this correctly, in fact, the refusal to pay had a $168,000 effect on your client. Bottom line, from her to or her husband to Ziegler Coal Company.
That's exactly right, Your Honor. In Metropolitan Stevedore versus Rambo, again, which is a longshore case, the Supreme Court said that modifying a compensation order generally affects future payments only, rather than retroactively adjusting a prior lump sum. That's the structure of the Act. Section 922 says such new order, a modification order, shall not affect any compensation previously paid.
So is it accurate to say that the BRB's rejection of your argument was based upon a misunderstanding of the law?
That's our position, Your Honor. Absolutely. And that's the second ground of our argument in prejudice, that when the administrative law judge finally reached the question of whether modification would serve justice under the Act, which, as this Court said in the Hilliard case, is grounded in the statist purpose of the Act to ensure that in the future adequate benefits are provided to coal miners and their dependents in event of their death or total disability due to pneumoconiosis, the reason for our rejecting our argument was both factually and legally just wrong. The ALJ, we think, was also wrong in saying that the only prejudice was to other coal companies. The first prejudice, of course, is it leads to a depletion of the trust fund when the trust fund has to step in to pay the monthly benefits when the coal company is not paying the monthly benefits that it's required to pay. But more importantly, it establishes an irrational system of adjudication. And this court and courts of appeals have routinely criticized black lung proceedings for going on for years and even decades. I'm in my 11th year of representing Mr. Crow, and his proceeding went on for more than 10 years prior to that. Because if a coal company may ignore its obligation to pay a final award instead seek modification with no penalty, it has no incentive to vigorously defend the initial claims. Now, to be sure, the statute which allows for modification does decrease the power of finality in black lung opinions, but or black lung proceedings. But if you don't require the initial payment to be effective and final in the initial proceeding, then there's absolutely no incentive for the coal company to vigorously defend an initial claim. Our last argument is that in the 2004 order, the Benefits Review Board exceeded its scope of review because ALJ Hilliard's rejection of the modification request was rational. In effect, what the board did was against the statute and required or instructed the ALJ that a finding of benefits could only be made if there was objective evidence under the Act, such as x-rays and lung tests, and this court has repeatedly said that is not the structure that Congress put in place. Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Spetta. For the defense, Ms. Klaus.
Thank you. May it please the Court. What this case is about is whether Mr. Crow was entitled to Blathlon benefits. And he was not. This was a remarkably weak case on the merits. Mr. Crow worked as a minor.
Was there a final payment order in 2001?
There was an order requiring the payment, and there was a request for modification based on a mistake of fact.
Well, but it was a final order, it wasn't appealed, and it wasn't paid. Why should the system tolerate that sort of an approach?
Because Congress passed a statute that permits an exception to the normal or traditional rules of finality, and that's the modification
right. Right, but do you agree that only has prospective effect?
It has prospective effect, but it also reaches back to the original order. It can't be viewed in a vacuum. If an employer like...
I'm reading from Section 922 from the Longshoremen's Act. Such new order shall not affect any compensation previously paid.
That's correct. It doesn't reach back to permit the employer to recoup any money that has been paid pursuant to that order, but it negates the order if modification is granted.
Okay. So what you're telling us then is that under that approach, the employer has... who believes a mistake has been made should do exactly what Ziegler did here, which is simply refuse to pay and start all over again.
That's correct, and the statute...
Is that a rational system?
It's the system that Congress designed, and it's the system that is implemented both in the statutory provisions and the regulations. The statute in 26 U.S.C. Section 9051 in 33 U.S.C. Section 921D, and in 20 CFR Section 725.522 says that when an employer refuses or declines to pay, the trust fund is the backstop. The trust fund then can initiate payments during the proceeding, and there is an incentive for these cases to be litigated to their end and to be litigated efficiently because if the employer is wrong, then the employer repays the trust fund with interest. The claimant, however, has no interest in who is paying him his benefits. It really doesn't matter to the claimant, or shouldn't, whether the payments are being made from Ziegler or from some other entity or from the Black Lung Disability Trust Fund. The claimant received benefits while the modification order was in effect, and then those benefits were stopped once the administrative law judge determined that modification was appropriate. And that was a rational finding, because Mr. Crow, the proof in the case did not establish that Mr. Crow had black lung disease or that he was totally disabled by any respiratory or pulmonary impairment, regardless of the source, let alone one due to his coal dust exposure.
Wasn't he receiving Social Security disability benefits since 1983?
He was receiving Social Security benefits, and he received a settlement of a state claim as well, in part from...
Social Security, we see a lot of those cases, and it's a very stringent standard.
The Social Security standard is not the same as the black lung standard. There are differences, and there is no offset either. So the issue, though, is did the ALJ's decision to deny this claim, is that decision supported by substantial evidence, and is it in accordance with law? And the answer to that is undisputably yes.
Well, when did your sureties or your insurer, as the case might be, know that your insured Ziegler had been dissolved?
This is a little complicated in the case of sureties. Ziegler was dissolved on September 30th, 2004. The issue of whether Travelers had a bond that might have covered an individual claim is not necessarily an easy one, and in fact it is a disputed issue, not for the agency to decide and not for this court to decide. There are separate proceedings for that, and that is in the district court.
Well, you know who you insure. I mean, this is the modern world. It's a very bureaucratized world. We have elaborate procedures. They knew who they insured. Now, they go under in 2004, and then for the first time, I'm told that you show up at a hearing saying, well, I kind of represent Ziegler, but of course you couldn't represent Ziegler because there was no such thing. So you're really representing the insurer, and we've even talked about conditional intervention in the papers. How can this be?
All right. Here's how this can be. Ziegler was dissolved by the bankruptcy court in September 30th, 2004. The bankruptcy court determined that pending cases, such as this one, would proceed with the debtor as the employer.
But its language, the language of that order referred to actions against the employer, correct?
And that's what this was.
Not the modification proceeding. That's a claim by the employer, right?
No. This is still...
Aren't you the moving party?
Yes, but the distinctions of the parties don't change. Parties don't... You have a claimant, and the claimant files a suit or a claim against an employer. The proponents, opponents, plaintiffs, defendants, those terminologies are not quite as applicable.
Then why didn't the bankruptcy order say any proceedings to which the employer is a party will proceed rather than just say claims against the employer?
Because that...
That's the way you're asking us to read it, right?
Mm-hmm. That's correct, and that's how everybody was reading it until the court's decision in Melvin. These cases proceeded with the employer as the party, and until Melvin, there was no requirement that a surety intervene.
Well, it took you another year after Melvin was decided to intervene in this case, right?
Well, Melvin, we filed the first motion to intervene in the first available time, and that was when the case returned to the ALJ. We filed a motion for leave to intervene in February of 2008.
And Melvin was decided in January of 2007.
Correct. And I believe that there were some reconsideration petitions. But, yes, when the case returned to the ALJ, then Travelers requested intervention. The judge denied it. When the case went to the Benefits Review Board, Travelers requested intervention, and the board granted it. So Travelers was a party in the proceedings before the agency, and it is a party in the proceedings before this court, which differentiates this case from Melvin. In the case that followed Melvin, Griskell, the court recognized in footnote 1 of that decision, because there too, Ziegler did not file a motion to intervene in the agency proceedings.
We were waiting to see. I mean, that's the real truth of the matter is that the insurer waited for the most opportune time. In other words, let's don't expose ourselves to any possible liability. But then old Ben comes out, the Melvin case, and said, now's the time to strike.
If you can credit people with clairvoyance or 20/20, yes. But what we were dealing with at this time was a bankruptcy court order that seemed to be clear to everyone until Melvin, that required the cases to proceed against the employer, not the sureties. There was no insurer here because Ziegler and Horizon were self-insured. But again, the sureties had no need to intervene based on what all of the parties, including the Department of Labor, understood the bankruptcy court order to say. When Melvin changed that, then the surety filed a motion for leave to intervene, and it was granted. That's a discretionary decision by the agency, and there was no abuse of discretion here.
Ms. Klaus, let me ask you, if we were to overturn the Benefit Review Board decision here, is Travelers, in fact, on the hook for payments?
Not necessarily.
Why not?
Because then at some point Travelers' defenses will have to be litigated. But that,
which are what?
That it's not the surety that covered this claim.
Okay. So you're not willing to admit that you're the surety that covered this claim.
No, and in our motion for conditional
intervention... What exactly is your position here?
Our position here is that the case should proceed like any other routine black lung case. The case proceeds against the employer. The administrative law judge adjudicates it, as he did here. If his decision is supported by substantial evidence and in accordance with law, as we believe it is, then the decision should be affirmed.
You take the position you're not the surety in parallel litigation in insurance coverage questions. You're there saying it's not us?
It's not parallel litigation. What happens is if we're correct, this case is over. If the court vacates the Benefits Review Board decision and returns the case to the agency, there are still issues that need to be litigated. But let's assume hypothetically that modification is denied. The order stays in effect. Then the Department of Labor has to go to the district court for enforcement of the order, and at that point in time, Travelers can raise its defenses on the surety bond. But that's not before the administrative agency.
I just don't see how you're here. What I just don't see what your standing is at all, because you won't even acquiesce and say, we are the surety for this company. But you say, no, we're not. But yet you want to fight this widow woman and her claim for federal black lung benefits.
The Department of Labor has notified Travelers that it might be the surety on this claim. Therefore, it has a stake in the outcome of the litigation. That makes us a party in interest, and that is the basis on which we sought to intervene, basically because this court said in Melvin that we had to do that in order to defend.
Okay. I understand your argument for Article III standing here, but what your ambivalent position suggests to me is that there was real strategic value to staying out of the case from Ziegler's dissolution in 2004 until your petition to intervene in 2008.
Well, actually, we filed an appearance in the case in November of 2005.
Sorry, we?
Greenberg Traurig. On behalf of the employer, as
did
we
not
believe
exist.
Was required by the bankruptcy
which
court.
Which did not exist.
It was determined first in Melvin that the bankruptcy court order wasn't as clear as everybody thought it was at the time.
You certainly didn't say we're here on behalf of the surety, did you?
No, we said we were here on behalf of the employer as the bankruptcy court order required us to do. And that was the position that the Department of Labor took as well.
But, of course, the bankrupt estate wasn't paying your firm to do this. The bankrupt estate wasn't funding this defense.
And this issue came up in Melvin as well, or in Griscoll, and there's no ill motive or anything unseemly about a surety paying for the defense of its purported principal, just like there is no
staying behind the curtain
motive behind an insurer paying for its lawyers to defend its insured. There's nothing ill conceived about this. This is the system that Congress devised for this, and this is the system that the bankruptcy court devised for how these proceedings were to go. The parties merely followed the rules.
What do you have to say, Ms. Klaus, about the thing that I guess I find so troubling is the incentive that's created for employers simply to refuse to pay final orders? And the BRB's apparent overlooking of the benefit to the employer's bottom line from that decision, and its decision by not paying the back benefits due under the 2001 order.
If an employer has a good faith defense, and because it cannot recover any funds that have been paid, the statute accommodates this, and it's done all the time. The Department of Labor also declined to pay back benefits when the claimant asked the Department of Labor to do so.
That's in a very different situation, right? Different law governs the trust fund, right?
And the statute provides, though, that if the employer declines to pay and is wrong, the employer has to reimburse the trust fund with interest.
The trust fund only makes prospective monthly payments, right?
They make current payments.
Right.
At times, they have also paid back benefits.
Okay, but that hasn't happened here, and instead what happened here was the employer was ordered to pay $168,000 in retroactive benefits. The order was final, it was not appealed, and the employer refused to pay. How is it consistent with the purposes of this statute to encourage that kind of an approach by an employer?
The statute doesn't encourage it, but the statute allows for the employer who believes that the decision was wrong. And in this case, Ziegler believed the decision was wrong, and with good reason. The case had been denied originally. It bounced back and forth. Ultimately, it was denied. This court gave the claimant a second chance when it, in 1997, returned the case to the agency for additional proceedings. On modification, the ALJ determined that the case did not have merit, that Mr. Crow was not entitled to benefits.
First he decided he was entitled to benefits,
and
right?
That decision was based on errors of law, and that's why the Benefits Review Board vacated it. When it went back again, the administrative law judge determined first that on the merits, his entitlement was not established, and second, that granting modification here was in the interest of justice. The judge didn't overlook anything. He didn't overlook the failure of the employer to pay. He didn't overlook the facts and circumstances of the case. His decision is well explained, it's thoughtful, and it is consistent with law.
Do we have jurisdiction to go back and consider whether the BRB's 2004 decision was correct or not?
We think that the court's jurisdiction extends to the final order, which would be the decision to the Benefits Review Board to affirm the ALJ's grant of modification.
Why doesn't it extend to all of the interlocutory decisions before, the non-final decisions before that?
Because 33 U.S.C. Section 921C states that appeals are from the final order of the agency, and that's the board's
right.
decision.
Right. Well, that, the same thing, though, happens with district. Why is this any different from an appellate court being able to go back and say that, no, after a first trial verdict was set aside by the court, the case is retried. It's not appealable until then. We can go back and say, no, it was a mistake, an abuse of discretion to set aside the result of the first trial. Can't we? Is this any different?
I suppose the court can. There's a difference of opinions among the circuits. In the Sixth Circuit, the court has said explicitly that it doesn't have jurisdiction to go back to the first vacated order because when the board vacated it, it returned the parties to the status quo ante, so its jurisdiction extends to the final decision. This court has indicated in other language that both predates the Bartley decision in the Sixth Circuit as well as postdates it that it can go back because there is no ability to challenge some of those interim orders.
Thank you, Ms. Klaus.
My time is up. Thank you very much.
Okay. Rebuttal, Mr. Spetta. How much time do we have?
One will look in vain in the statute to find any suggestion that a good faith refusal to pay is sanctioned. The statute puts the trust fund in a backup position because the administrative agency has no way to enforce an order short of going to court, and the trust fund is there to make sure monthly payments are paid. But they're not allowed under the Internal Revenue Code to pay the back benefits. The second is that Ms. Klaus's argument that the terminologies of who is the proponent are irrelevant is simply contradicted by the Rambo case from the Supreme Court, where the court asked who has the burden of proof in modification, answered it under the formal rules of the APA that said because this is a proceeding for a new order, the proponent is the coal company. Last, this idea that they didn't have to do anything before Melvin strikes me as odd. The opinion from this court in Melvin has every tone that this is an easy case. Why? The February 2005 letter from the department to the Aetna says you ought to intervene here, and we cited the regulations and the statute, which are plain on their face. If you want to protect your interest, you have to intervene. Thank you, Your Honor.
Thank you, Mr. Spetta. Thank you, counsel. The case is taken under advisement.